Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Paulistic Behind the Curtain here on WGN Plus, where we air on Saturdays and Sundays. And as you know, hang with us, because on Monday morning, we shift over to WGNradio.com and all the other podcast platforms where you get to watch and hear this show again. One of my favorite shows of all time, and I'm not alone in this, is The Sopranos. It's one of HBO's very first super mega hits. I think it remains maybe as their all-time hit of all time, potentially. We'll find out. But it is, of course, one of the greatest shows of all time. And out comes a book recently about Jim Gandolfini. I actually called him James, but I guess it was Jim. Jim Gandolfini. The book is called Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend, because, of course, he did play Tony Soprano. And joining me to talk about this, along with the copy of the book in hand, Jason Bailey. He's a film critic, a historian. He's written books on Richard Pryor. Got one coming out on Die Hard. But, man, you top it all when you're talking about Jim Gandolfini, Jason.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for reading the book, which not everyone I talk to has. So I appreciate
Yeah, no, I do, and I couldn't wait to read this one because I was a huge Gandolfini fan. We'll talk a lot about things that people don't know. Then they can read the book themselves. Yeah. I almost feel like it's a waste to ask you why you wrote it, because it's James Gandolfini. So you wanted to get into it. But how much access did you get? It looks like you've interviewed a lot of people. Maybe not everybody would talk to you, but talk to me about the access to make this an accurate account of his life.
Right. I mean, that was the access is always the tricky part when you're doing a biography, especially when it is, as this one is, technically an unauthorized biography. I approached the family early on to ask for their participation. They declined, but like very politely, you know what I mean? I had a very nice conversation with his son, Michael, who is a wonderful guy. And as we are finding out, also a tremendous actor.
Yeah, an actor, yeah.
They basically took a stance of, you know, they didn't want to get involved, but they also didn't stand in my way. They didn't, you know, tell anybody not to talk to me. It was nothing of that nature. But it was a question of, okay, well, if we don't have that kind of direct access, you know, who do we talk to? Will they talk to us? And there were a few that we didn't get that I would have liked to have gotten. You know, David Chase declined. Luckily, he'd given lots of interviews that I was able to pull from. But for the most part, we got almost everyone we approached to talk to us. A lot of the cast and crew of The Sopranos were happy to talk. A lot of the actors and directors that he worked with on his films. It really, in those situations, it's a matter of building trust, you know, of making sure that they understand your intentions, that you're not out to write something that's going to be sensationalistic or, you know, sort of rumor mongering or anything like that.
Since you did get a lot of those people, we're going to talk about the characters, but the one person I didn't see a lot on in the book, and so maybe he wouldn't talk to you, is Uncle June. Uncle June, your Dominic Chianese. So what did he participate, and or we don't see a lot about him in the book. I was curious why.
Yeah, I reached out to him and didn't hear back from his people after a couple of inquiries.
Oh, okay.
So and that was unfortunate, because I admire him a lot as an actor. But again, he'd given a few interviews through the years. I was able to sort of pull some things here and there. And that sort of became the trick. It's like, okay, well, if they won't talk to me, then that's where the research piece of it comes in. That's where you go about tracking down every time they might have talked about him. That's right. Where you go about listening to all of the Talking Sopranos podcast episodes. That's where you really have to sort of, okay, you know, I want to at least make sure their voice is in here somewhere.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about Gandolfini, because what was really interesting, not surprising to me, but first of all, the Tony Soprano character he created, which I think went beyond his and everybody's expectations, truly became larger than life. And you do have one of the, it might have been Stevie Van Zandt, but somebody makes the point that Tony Soprano became to Gandolfini what Columbo was to Peter Falk or Kojak to Telly Savalas, meaning the character became such a part of our fabric of culture and society, he could really never escape it. And I'm guilty, because as I watched him do other things both before and after, I gotta be honest, Jason, it was just always Tony Soprano to me, but that wasn't a bad thing.
Right. No, I mean, it speaks to the incredible shadow that character cast, not only over his career, but over popular culture in general. And you're right. You know, Vinnie Pastore actually was who had made that point to me about that sort of Peter Falk and, you know, Telly Savalas comparison. And I think what's important to know, and what some folks may not know if they only know him from The Sopranos, was how vastly different from that character he was in every imaginable way. You know, he wasn't like a murderer, you know, but or a gangster. But
no, but you describe him as humble. that he was tough, but he was smart. And I'm going to jump ahead to one little thing, that he himself saw himself as Jackie Gleason as a
Very
model
much.
for him, which, you know, that means you can make him cry and you can make him laugh.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when people asked him that, you know, he loved dumb comedies. Like that was the kind of thing he liked to do and wanted to do more of, and really made an effort after The Sopranos to do more comedy. The other quote that I sort of tracked, which changed as his weight changed, was he used to love to describe himself as like a 260-pound Woody Allen, that he was neurotic, that he was sort of self. He was very hard on himself. He was constantly sort of worried about what was going on in his life and in his career. You know, the confidence and machismo with which Tony Soprano carried himself was completely different from the kind of person that Jim was.
And so, as you said, very different. Here's what I didn't know I learned from your book, if I have this right. They even talked to him about when I think Carell was going to leave The Office, about stepping into The Office. That blew my mind.
Yeah, and he wanted to do that. That was like, because again, he loved comedy, wanted to do more comedy, and was looking to do something that would sort of replace Tony Soprano as the sort of go-to image for him. What ended up happening on that was that, you know, NBC made him a pretty generous offer, and HBO topped that offer for him to not go do that show because they had a production deal going with him, mostly as a producer, but still they wanted sort of him to remain identified with HBO. And so he ended up getting paid more to not take over The Office than he would have if he had taken it on.
Well, what I love about the book, among other things, is first of all, there's tons of chapters, which means they're kind of short, so I could read a few, go to
Sure.
sleep, that kind of thing, and do that. But I noticed that not all, but many of the chapters are simply titled with the first name of a person: Bucky, Mitch, Charlie, Michael, Al. Give me the theory of what was going on there as you decided each chapter will be a person name.
Well, the sort of the big idea that I went into writing the book with, and which luckily my research and interviews bore out, which is always a good thing. Sometimes you find out your entire line of thinking is wrong, was that really Jim spent his life in a search for identity. You know, there was a certain kind of person that he was expected to be, a certain kind of person that he wanted to be. And then when he attained this massive out of nowhere stardom, a certain kind of person that everyone expected him to be. And somewhere in between all of those was the real person. And that sort of became the framework, the mystery, if you will, that I was trying to solve with the book was, who was what that search for identity was for him, and when and where did he find it? And the chapter titles that you mentioned come out of two things. First of all, a lot of them come from the nicknames that he had acquired throughout his life through different groups of people that he would hang out with in different phases. And this is one of the first things I was told by Karen Duffy, actually, the MTV personality who graduated high school with him in Park Ridge, New Jersey, was that you would figure out when Jim had met someone in his life by what they called him. So, like, to people like her who knew him from high school, he was Feeny. But then in college, his college buddies called him Bucky. And then he was James for a while, and then Jimmy for. And so this is sort of how you would pocket these out. So some of the chapters have those names as their titles. And then other ones, it's the title of a character that he played, that he, especially early on, you know, this was a method trained actor. He trained in the Meisner method. He was a very intensive actor. He took that work very seriously. And so in a lot of ways, he would sort of become these characters as he played them. And so that sort of became part of the big idea there, that these different people he played in films and on television were sort of stops in that search for his identity. And so that
And
was where the titling idea came from.
people, of course, identify with him for TV and the movies that we, you know, now we know who this guy is. But he had a theater career as well, a Streetcar Named Desire with Alec Baldwin. I mean, he was, you know, but yet he was a part-time actor. He had to have other jobs. He struggled like anybody else. But what I loved is he never gave up Jersey. Even when he was in the big dollars, his mansion, so to speak, was in Jersey.
Yes, exactly. You know, those Jersey roots, that working class background, that immigrant background of his family that he came from it was really important to me to detail that as much as I could in those early chapters. And I know when I'm reading a biography, sometimes I sort of skim those childhood pages. I'm like, I'm more interested in the stuff that I know about.
Get me to the Sopranos. Heard of.
Yes, get me to the Sopranos. But I did everything I could to really dig into that period, because so much of who he was as a person, his generosity financially, emotionally, professionally to his peers, so much of that was because of this very distinct working class background that he came out of, that he took none of it for granted. He assumed it was all luck, and he wanted to share as much of his wealth and himself as he could.
But you talk about his generosity. There were stories that he would help people who were like in prison and go see them. Yeah. Or if the wife of a friend was sick, it was Christmas Day, right? And he would go, no, Jim, it's Christmas Day. He was a regular human being who understood his friendships. That was just a great thing to talk about. Let's take just a moment to talk about his personal relationships. Married a couple of times, Marcy, where he had a son, Michael, as you know, and then Deborah later on in his life. And he seems to find himself more comfortable in the Deborah relationship because apparently the divorce papers from the first one might have gotten him in a little trouble, from what you write.
Yeah, you know, the first marriage was a tricky marriage, and it was sort of a shotgun marriage. Michael was born 6 months after they were married. There was some question as to whether that was the right move for both of them at that time. It was a pretty short-lived and troubled marriage, and there were some sort of salacious details that came out in the aftermath. One of the things that I tried to sort of figure out and understand and track in the book was sort of his journey to personal peace and happiness in addition to identity. You know, those Sopranos years were hard for him because he's going through all of these personal troubles that we're talking about. He's in the spotlight in a way that he had never anticipated. Some of his substance abuse issues are starting to bubble up as, you know, sort of as a coping mechanism for all those woes. But it felt like towards the end of his life, he had finally sort of calmed that all down, settled down, and found a kind of inner peace in his second marriage to Deborah. He had a tiny baby girl who was barely a year old when he passed in 2013. That's sort of one of the tragedies of his life, is that it felt like a peace that he'd been working towards, he had finally attained when he left.
One more quickie question before we go to break. He did a movie, Surviving Christmas, and of course, you're talking primarily, I think, to Chicagoland here. He filmed that, at least a couple of weeks of it, in Chicago. Do we have any insight that he loved this town? Tell me he loved this town.
He did. He had a really good time in Chicago, from what I understand, yes. Didn't end up with a great movie on the outcome of it, but certainly didn't. But certainly enjoyed the process, yeah.
We're going to take a break, and you know what I'm going to take you to when we come back after this break?
What's that?
Sopranos.
Yay!
That's what people, we know people want to hear, and we're going to do that, and all sorts of interesting information when we are back here on Behind the Curtain. Stay with us. We are back on Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Lisnick, and I'm talking to Jason Bailey, who wrote this phenomenal book on James Gandolfini called Gandolfini. Here he is holding it up. Jim, Tony, the life of a legend. All right, Jason, we got to get into The Sopranos. This is what people are waiting for. I mean, we've talked about it, but let's get into it. First of all, what I find really interesting about this is, you know, the role of his mother in the show, Nancy Marchand, and we're going to talk about her, but I found that Gandolfini kind of had strong women in his life, as an important piece of this. You write about the fact that his mother, whose name was Santa Pena Gandolfini, when she passed, he wouldn't talk about it publicly. I just had the sense that maybe it was about women, maybe it was his mother. Women were a very powerful force for him, and we see that in Tony Soprano.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things he said that initially attracted him to the character, was the fact that he was this, you know, powerful man around all the other men in his life, and all of the women in his life had it, from his mother to his wife to his daughter to his therapist, have him absolutely henpecked all the way through the show. But, you know, I hadn't really made that connection until you said it, and that's 100% right. All through his life, you know, his mother's a strong influence. His longtime acting partner and ultimately dialogue coach, the woman who worked with him throughout The Sopranos, is this amazing actress named Susan Astin, who I was lucky enough to talk to. The first interview I did, actually, was with her. And his first important acting teacher was a woman named Catherine Gately. All through his life, there were these women who were very strong, important influences and figures in his life. And I think that's interesting that that's reflected in the show. You're right.
In getting the role, by the way, this is something I think it was CBS passed on it on taking the the
Many
pilot.
networks passed on that front on the network level and into the cable level. It was really kind of a Hail Mary when HBO grabbed it because at that time they were not known for hour-long dramas.
And it was also the right thing for HBO because they could do things in The Sopranos on HBO they couldn't do on any of those
Absolutely.
networks. And there were issues about some of those things.
Absolutely.
But what I loved is the way Gandolfini got the role, because you write about the fact that David Chase, who created the show, he's at dinner, somebody's pitching Gandolfini to him, and essentially, I mean, my words now, but basically Chase goes, "Look, I'm drinking. I'm not going to remember this in the morning, so send me something."
Right. And they sent him a tape, his manager, who I spoke to, sent his reel, which obviously this is the days of the videotape reel with clips from what they do. And they showcase an actor's versatility. And they said because of Jim's physical appearance, they really tried on that reel to showcase his vulnerability, the sort of non-tough guy roles that he could do. She gets a call from Chase and he's like, "Oh yeah, I've seen this guy around. He's very good. My only concern is, can he be threatening enough?"
He's not tough enough.
And is he tough enough? And she burst out laughing. She said, "Look, if your concern is weight, I understand. If your concern is a hairline, I understand. You don't have to worry about Jim Gandolfini being threatening enough to play this
Oh, that
character."
is so true. Many people may not know that Carmela, who of course was played by Edie Falco, but initially the thought was it would be Lorraine Bracco, but it was a role too close to something she was well known for.
Right. They offered her that role initially, and she passed on it because she had been in Goodfellas, which really, especially if you watch Goodfellas now, its influence on The Sopranos is so obvious, and not just in terms of tone and subject matter, but so many actors who ended up on The Sopranos are in big and small roles in Goodfellas. She didn't want to repeat herself, and so they had this idea then of casting her as Dr. Melfi.
And again, playing his mother, Nancy Marchand, who was in Lou Grant, she was known from that, very different characters.
Oh,
But
yeah.
she passed away after the first few seasons of the series. And apparently, as you write, she was ill from the get-go. They knew she was ill, knew at some point she might pass away. And I think she talked to the producers about saying, just when it happens, work with it.
Yeah, that was when she came in for her first meeting. It was, in a New York walk-up, and she's coughing and hacking. And yeah, she had this diagnosis in place and was very upfront with them about it. She said, "If you're worried about this, I understand. You don't have to cast me." And they thought she was so good that they figured, you know what, we'll roll with the punches. We'll deal with it come what may. And thankfully they did, because it really is, it's such an indelible performance. And the dynamic between her and Gandolfini was so sharp.
And I believe she may have passed away before they had thought she might, because there were an
Right.
episode or two where they had to use just old footage and put it in
Yep.
again to kind of close off some of the scenes.
Right.
Some of these other characters were just, I mean, we can go forever for this, but like Tony Sirico, who's in it. I didn't know he actually had a life of crime in his early life and
Sure
ended up
did. Sure
acting.
did. Had a very colorful past. Yeah. And then sort of turned to acting as a way to clean up his act. And before this show, in addition to Goodfellas, he was a regular Woody Allen stock player. He turns up in things like Bullets Over Broadway, Mighty Aphrodite, playing gangsters, which is always entertaining to see.
And Stevie Van Zandt from, of course, Springsteen fame,
Right.
as I understand it, they created this role for him, right? There was thoughts about him doing something else, but essentially it's like, you got to be in the show, they create Cilio.
Yeah, he was one of the three finalists for the role of Tony Soprano, because Chase had seen him at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony in like a suit and, a hat, and he said he has the right look. This was sort of what he was seeing in his mind. Of course, he didn't play the role, but they did. They created this Silvio character for him, and he told me, he said the thing that he loved about being on The Sopranos was he felt like he was Tony's sideman, the way he is Bruce's sideman in the band. And I thought that was a wonderful analogy.
And just one more, Vincent Pastore, who you've mentioned before, but he was a nightclub manager, becomes an
Yeah.
actor. I mean, these stories are like regular people who then turn to this and become part of
Yeah.
this legacy.
One of the things I love about Vinny Pastore is that, yeah, he said that even though Jim had become famous later in his life, he'd been acting long enough that Vinny would look to Jim for acting advice. He would go to him for coaching or for ideas of how to, like he said, he was having trouble memorizing lines initially because he'd never had as many lines as he had on The Soprano. And Jim taught him his method of learning lines, which is to write them out on like 3x5 index cards with the cue on the front and your line on the back, and just go through them like flashcards. Which has been wonderful for me because my daughter is a young actor. She's 11. She got her first big play this year and she asked me, how do I memorize these lines? And I said, I know a method. I could teach you the James Gandolfini method. And it worked
And
for her too.
have you taught her the James Gandolfini method for getting into the mood of a scene, such as what was called by, I think, Robert Eiler, who played his son, the breathing thing,
Yes.
the smoking of a lucky strike? That's a little
Right.
strange.
Yeah, he wasn't a smoker, but sometimes when he needed to get into the right mood for a scene, he would do that. Sometimes when he needed to be mad in a scene, he would put a little rock in his shoe and walk around for it on it. And my favorite thing that Robert Eiler told me, just because it's such a vivid image, is that he said Jim would keep that heavy bathrobe on all day when they were doing scenes where he was wearing it. Even though they're shooting in Jersey in the summer or they're indoors under hot studio lights, he would keep that thing on just to feel the weight of the robe and the weight of the character and to let him sort of get him in a tizzy.
We could do a whole episode just on various episodes of The Sopranos. We don't have time for that, just a few minutes left, but a couple of brief things. The pilot is all about the ducks in the... What's with the ducks?
I mean, that has become sort of one of the indelible images of Jim, is him in the pool with those ducks. And the idea of sort of a certain innocence, a certain remove from everyday life, the way that those ducks became an outlet for him that was taken from him. I think it's such a fascinating, inciting action for that show. And certainly not what any of us were expecting when we tuned in to watch a weekly show about a gangster.
And episode 5 of the first season called College, I loved reading about this because this is the first time we see Tony kill somebody. And there was
right.
a lot of issues, right? We can't have Tony kill. We can't have him do it. And then it's like, he's got to do this. And of course, it's a classic episode.
Fierce pushback from HBO on that one because, you know, this is what's hard to describe to maybe younger people about why this show was so groundbreaking, is that so many of the conventions of contemporary television began with The Sopranos. So now you say a character, you know, this is a leading character who's a killer, who's an anti-hero, who's not immediately sympathetic. And that's like a cliche by now. But at that time, there was real concern that they would lose viewers if they watched this man murder someone with his bare hands.
There's a salary negotiation part of the book here. The friends were, thanks to David Schwimmer and group, $1 million an episode. These guys weren't making anywhere near that. I think you said Jim got maybe $400,000 for an episode, but for what they were going through. But we have a couple of minutes left. I want to talk about his passing. It was sudden. Nobody expected it. Robert Eiler wouldn't even go to the funeral. The funeral, they were just so blown away by this. It's just in a very emotional section of the book.
Yeah. You know, people still that I talk to still get emotional and choked up when they talk about his passing, when they talk about his beautiful funeral. You know, he did not take the greatest care of himself. So it wasn't that anyone was shocked, per se, I was told. They were just surprised. He, like I said, was really on a path to mental health. He'd gotten his substance abuse issues under control. He had his career going in sort of the right direction and was doing a lot of different kinds of roles.
He was in therapy while they were doing the show. He was in therapy for real.
Right. So he was really working on all of that. And the idea that, you know, at a certain point, though, your body can only take so much abuse. But it was the outpouring of grief, of emotion, and then luckily of stories. You know, so many of his acts of kindness, financial kindness especially, he swore people to secrecy. He didn't want these to be stories that were out in the press. But then after he passed, a lot of his colleagues, friends, collaborators felt free to sort of finally tell these stories of his generosity and really gift us all with a much clearer idea of who this remarkable actor and man was.
10 seconds to answer this one. When you're finished the project, the book comes out, what one thing do you want people to know about Jim Gandolfini?
That he wasn't Tony Soprano. That he was this warm, gentle, bearded, Birkenstock-wearing, kind of a hippie dude. He was just warm and gregarious and wonderful. And a tremendous actor, much more versatile than he gets credit for.
The book is Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend by Jason Bailey. Thank you, sir. I loved reading it so much. Thank you for writing it.
I appreciate that.
I can't wait for the
next
one coming out. Thanks for everybody for joining us here on Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next week.